Our speaker for this evening is Dr. Henry Fritz of the St. Olaf History Department. Dr. Fritz is an authority on Indian-White relations and has written on the subject. In 1963, he published a book entitled The Movement for Indian Assimilation. Currently, he is on leave from the chairmanship of the History Department for the purpose of revising that book. In 1972, he was a speaker on Indian-White relations at the Washington Conference on Indian-White Relations held at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. He has given numerous courses at St. Olaf on Indian-White relations and currently is teaching a course on the Indians of the Southwest during interim. This evening, his lecture will be entitled Federal Policy Toward Native Americans Before Wounded Knee. Dr. Fritz.
Thank you, and good evening. I suppose one of the things about my address I need not make note of, and that is to say that I cannot come to you with an Indian point of view. Nevertheless, I would like to make an effort to provide an overview of Indian-White relations within the United States, to develop some background and at the same time hopefully reflect upon where I think the United States is today in its relations with Native Americans. A week or so ago, a question was raised about the title of my remarks. The question was, which wounded knee? Well, I have set for myself something that may be too large a task, and that is to deal in some respects with the backgrounds of both. The two are, after all, related in that on both occasions, the Indian people, and particularly the Teton or Western Sioux, were split into factions, those who accepted government policy and those who did not. On both occasions, two militants lived apart from the Indian agencies and prepared to challenge the federal policy and the established order on the reservations. Well, December 29, 1890 was indeed a tragic day in American history. Neither Indian nor white people would want to celebrate that occasion as part of the nation's bicentennial. I think you are aware of the current debate over whether it should be labeled a massacre. And I may say that that depends partly upon your definition of the term. However the definition goes, it was a scene of frightful carnage, with at least 150 Sioux dead and another 50 wounded. At least, possibly 200 dead. A fact that is seldom mentioned, however, is that the carnage also took its toll on the side of the army, for they numbered among their losses 25 dead and 39 wounded. I am concerned more this evening with the question of why such a tragedy occur. So far as the documents reveal, at least, the Army did not deliberately set out to kill these people. Rather, their intention was to overawe and disarm them. But I would like to go back to the origin of this event. Since the 1860s, the Army had been directed to pursue recalcitrant tribesmen who refused to come into the agencies and settle down to a sedentary life on the reservations. And by the middle 1870s, it was federal policy to use the military to disarm nomadic warriors who frequently hunted and made raids off of the reservations. Now, it was about this time that the Black Hills were invaded by swarms of gold seekers who violated the Treaty of 1868, the treaty that created the Great Sioux Reservation, comprising all of South Dakota west of the Missouri River. After a brief effort to keep the miners out, the government ordered the Sioux to gather at their agencies or be subject to pursuit by the Army. This pursuit was to occur within the reservation itself and in the hunting grounds that lay to the west, hunting grounds that were guaranteed by the Treaty of 1868. As you probably know, it was during this attempt to round up the Teton Sioux that General George Armstrong Custer and his entire battalion were killed in the Battle of the Little Big Horn, June 25th, 1876. By definition, that was not a massacre, because on the Indian side, at least, it was an unplanned event. Robert Epley, in his book, on the Frontier Regulars, which appeared a couple of years ago, says that to be a massacre, it has to be a planned event. And of course, the Army has taken that book and made the most of it in its current plea, which has been appearing in the newspapers. Well, despite this victory over Custer on the part of the Sioux, the Army completed its work by 1881, and Congress then proceeded to reduce the reservation areas to the ones we are familiar with today. Now, while this Sioux War was in progress, serious trouble began in the Southwest. There, Victorio and Geronimo began a series of raids that terrorized the non-Indian populations of New Mexico, Arizona, and Mexico itself, south of the border. General George Crook had forced the Apaches to settle on reservations in the 1870s. But by the end of that decade, both Victorio and Geronimo were determined not to accept assimilation for their people. As it turned out, Victorio died of a Mexican bullet, fired ironically by an Indian auxiliary assisting the Mexican troops. And thus it was Geronimo who provided the final challenge to the Army in the Southwest. Now, during the summer of 1881, a shaman named Nakedoklini began preaching a religious doctrine that involved the return of the Indian dead and the demise of the white population, involving a special dance. Nakedoklini's religion resembled somewhat the ghost dance, which was to sweep the plains 8 or 9 years later. Well, it was in the midst of excitement caused by such preaching that the San Carlos agent, J.C. Tiffany, grew alarmed and called upon the military at Fort Apache to arrest and, if necessary, to kill the medicine man. This task fell to Colonel Eugene Carr of the 6th Cavalry, who was ordered to arrest Nacredo Clini, and who proceeded to do so with very grave misgivings, because he knew that violence was likely to result. Well, his fears were well justified. 85 cavalrymen, assisted by 23 White Mountain Scouts, that is Apaches, did successfully arrest Naco de Clini on Cibacu Creek, 30 miles northwest of Fort Apache. But angry Apache warriors attacked the military column as it returned to Fort Apache. The scouts mutinied, and in the melee, a wounded sergeant shot and killed the medicine man. In the aftermath of this tragic event, Fort Apache itself came under attack. And because somebody needed to be blamed, the departmental commander, whose name was General Orlando Wilcox, preferred charges against Colonel Carr. It was, in fact, General Wilcox who was to blame for giving in to the demands of Agent Tiffany. And subsequently, a court of inquiry cleared Carr of the charges. Well, excitement caused by this event prompted the General of the Army, William Tecumseh Sherman, to order an end to the Apache depredations. Reinforcements were sent to the southwest, and the concentration of troops at San Carlos was more than Geronimo of the Chiricahuas could bear. As one authority has written, and I quote, "Conditions at San Carlos would have severely tried the most docile and obedient Indians. The Apaches were neither docile nor obedient." General Crook later wrote, "These tigers of the human race resented anything like an attempt to regulate their conduct or in any way to interfere with their mode of life," which of course is what the reservation was all about. Raiding, after all, was central to the culture of the Apaches. They had lived by this means for centuries, and neighboring Indian people, as well as the white communities, suffered from such raids. Also, it must be said that Geronimo and his followers were fond of brewing tiswin, a crude whiskey that was fermented from corn sprouts. Wife beating, a common practice among Apaches, was prohibited on the reservation. These prohibitions against things that Geronimo considered to be a part of his culture caused him to chafe under the control of the Indian agent, who could always turn to the army for support. Well, my point is that all of these reasons figured in Geronimo's decision to break out in 1883 and again in 1885. By making forays back and forth across the border, the Apache leaders gave the authorities of the United States and Mexico an extremely hard time. Finally, in 1886, it was all over, as Geronimo learned that his people were being moved to Florida. It was only then that he decided really on his own to surrender to General Miles and return to Arizona. The point is that the Chiricahuas and the Warm Springs Apaches were removed from the territory of Arizona in response to the demands of irate Arizona citizens. Incidentally, the men and the women were separated, the men going to Fort Marion, the women to Fort Pickens. Geronimo was betrayed because it was his understanding that he would be allowed to return to Arizona after a short interval. As a matter of fact, the Apaches did not get back to Arizona in the near future. Geronimo never returned at all. They did get to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where Geronimo died in 1907, and it was 1913 before any of the removed Apaches got back to their homeland. This, of course, involved white men's duplicity. White men's duplicity caused by the demands of the white citizenry. And that duplicity is seen once more in the fact that the scouts who assisted General Miles and General Crook before him suffered the same fate as did Geronimo and his followers. That is, the scouts went to Florida for incarceration along with the rest. Now, I've told this story of Apache resistance in the Southwest because I believe it is essential background for an understanding of the first Wounded Knee. As in Arizona and New Mexico, the hostile Sioux tribesmen had been forced to reside on reservations, and those reservations were reduced in size to accommodate the encroaching white population. The Teton Sioux were by their very nature a nomadic people. Life without hunting was no life at all. And the economic basis of Sioux culture had been demolished by hide hunters who killed at least 10 million buffalo by 1880. These people were then asked to reside on reservations, to subsist on scant rations, and to learn to support themselves by farming while their children were taught white men's language and white men's religion. I don't think it's surprising at all that they longed for the old life and that they became excited by the teachings of Wovoka. Being quite desperate because their culture was being undermined, if not destroyed, the warlike chiefs grasped eagerly at the teachings which accompanied the ghost dance, a religion which originated among the Paiutes of Nevada. Now, as practiced by the Paiutes, it was a peaceable religion that blended Christianity with native beliefs. Live in peace, love one another, devote yourselves to work or common strictures. There was a rather strict moral code. And by dancing themselves into a trance, these followers of Wovoka were promised a vision of things to come. The white people were going to disappear, fall into holes in the ground, and the Indian ghosts would return to live life in the old way with plenty of game to support them. The millennium was set for the spring of 1891. Now, it was on the northern plains among the Sioux that the ghost dance religion took on a militant quality. There it was taught that the practitioners of the dance could do something to rid the country of the white people, and that wearing ghost shirts would make Sioux warriors impervious to the bullets of white and incidentally black soldiers as well. Pine Ridge became the center of tension. From there, Kicking Bear made converts among the Oglalas and spread the religion to Rosebud, Cheyenne River, and Standing Rock. Kicking Bear and Short Bull of the Oglalas withdrew from the Pine Ridge Agency and took up a headquarters at a place called the Stronghold, in the northeastern portion of the Pine Ridge Reservation. It was at this point that D.F. Royer, a political appointee as agent, panicked, reminding me very much of Tiffany in the Southwest. He couldn't control the Oglalas, and so he called in the troops, November the 12th, 1890. The very next day, President Harrison issued an order which gave the War Department responsibility for suppressing any outbreaks among the Sioux. Well, this is what General Nelson Miles had been waiting for. You see, General Miles, who had brought in, who was in command in the Southwest when Geronimo was brought in, was now in command of the military department of the Missouri. And as I say, this is what he had been waiting for, because Miles was one who held very strongly that the War Department could do a better job of managing Indian affairs than could the Interior Department. This was his main chance. If he could successfully disarm the Sioux, whereas the civilian agent, D.F. Royer, had failed to control the Oglalas, a very strong argument could be made in favor of military control of those Sioux agencies. But for the time being, there was no outbreak. Then at Standing Rock, Agent James McLaughlin sent the Indian police to arrest Sitting Bull, who was a leader of the Ghost Dance on that reservation. Now let me explain that the Indian police were Indians who had been organized into a police force so that the civilian agents would not have to depend upon the army in controlling life within the reservations, in controlling the Indian people who were settled there. And James McLaughlin was, of course, anxious to show that the Indian police, who were Sioux, could do the job. Therefore, he ordered the Indian police early on the morning of December 15th to go to Sitting Bull's camp and arrest the chief. This was dynamite, because Sitting Bull was supported by Ghost Dance followers. And when the Indian police came to his camp and dragged him from his cabin, the Indian police became embroiled in a fight with the Ghost Dance followers of Sitting Bull. When it was all over, quite a number of Sioux on both sides lay dead, including the old chief himself. Well, news of Sitting Bull's death spread rapidly. 400 Unkpapa dancers carried the news to the reservation of the Minneconjou at Cheyenne River. At this point, it became apparent that the federal government intended to arrest all leaders of the Ghost Dancers. And it was this fear, by the way, that caused Bigfoot and his people to head south toward Pine Ridge. Bigfoot himself was not anxious to leave the reservation. He did so reluctantly, but leave it he did. Having left Cheyenne River, Bigfoot now came entirely under military jurisdiction, and General Miles assumed that he was heading for the stronghold on Pine Ridge Reservation to join with the militant Oglalas led by Kicking Bear and Short Bull. In fact, Bigfoot was not very militant, as I've just indicated, and his destination happened to be the Pine Ridge Agency itself. Besides, at this time, the Minneconjou chief was suffering greatly with pneumonia to the point of spitting blood. Well, Colonel James Forsyth of the 7th Cavalry was assigned the task of intercepting Bigfoot's band. There were 120 warriors, 230 women and children. That is 350 people approximately altogether. Forsyth's purpose was to disarm the warriors, who had obtained Winchester repeating rifles and a good supply of ammunition. See, the military was always complaining about the traitors who supplied these Indians with arms, which they in turn had to take away from them. Anyway, when the 7th Cavalry caught up with Bigfoot, he agreed only to accept a military escort to the Pine Ridge Agency, which was yet some 18 miles away. And on the evening of December 28th, both the Minneconjous and the 7th Cavalry went into camp at Wounded Knee Creek. By this time, Forsyth himself had come on the scene with orders to take away all firearms from Bigfoot's people and to march them to the railroad in Nebraska for movement to Omaha. This was the task that the cavalry undertook on the morning of December 29th. The Minneconjou awoke to find 4 Hotchkiss cannons, rapid-fire Gatling guns, trained on their encampment. And with that kind of firepower backing them up, the cavalry dismounted, moved in, demanding the rifles. Bigfoot said no. Give them the old firearms, but not the Winchesters. Yellowbird, a medicine man and a practitioner of the ghost dance, began to harangue the warriors that their ghost shirts would offer protection. He threw dust in the air as he talked excitedly to inspire courage. Then a deaf warrior by the name of Black Coyote raised his rifle over his head and said, apparently, that he would not give it up unless he were paid for it. It had cost him too much. At that point, soldiers moved in to take the rifle by force, and in the struggle, the weapon went off. Apparently, that was the signal that brought violence, as warriors threw aside their blankets and opened fire on the dismounted cavalry at close range. Now, I suppose I should caution you that I am operating from documents which are found in the National Archives, but what is said here is also backed up by the Ricker investigation, which follows soon after. Judge Ricker was a resident of Nebraska, and his papers are in the Nebraska Historical Society. Next, there came a flurry of hand-to-hand combat, followed by a rush of warriors, women and children, to get out of the camp. It was at this point that the Hotchkiss cannon began firing on the fleeing Indians. 3 days later, burial details gathered the bodies of dead Sioux for interment in a mass grave near the Sacred Heart Church. Given the extensive carnage and the overwhelming odds that favored the cavalry, it is clear why most historians have called Wounded Knee a massacre. Remains, however, to be said that General Miles was furious with Colonel Forsyth and immediately removed him from his command, accusing this officer of incompetence and irresponsibility. Now, perhaps this was merely a maneuver for shifting the blame, as Wilcox had done with Colonel Carr in the Southwest. In any case, a court of inquiry cleared Forsyth and restored him to his command. I would suggest that more than the desire to find a scapegoat was involved here, because with the tragedy at Wounded Knee, Miles lost his chance to get permanent control of the Sioux agencies. The old controversy between the War and Interior Department as to which was more capable of managing Indian affairs was over. Never again would the Army have anything to do with the Indian people of the United States. Forsyth, of course, did commit a blunder, and that was the blunder of trying to forcibly disarm these people at Wounded Knee Creek, 18 miles from the agency. Had he simply gone along with the agreement of the day before to act as a military escort to Bigfoot's band, it seems quite likely that the disarming of the Minneconjou could have taken place quite peaceably at Pine Ridge. And in this I see a great tragedy, if not a massacre. I guess I am more interested in discussing the significance of Wounded Knee. And I would give you four main points of significance. First, as I've already indicated, it brought to an end the role that the military had exercised in forcing Indian people to accept the federal policy of assimilation. Second, the proud Indian warriors were brought to concede that they could not return to the old ways of living with plenty of buffalo and no white people to encroach upon their lands. At least this generation of warriors, of militants, conceded that. And third, the ghost dance religion quickly died out, as Wounded Knee demonstrated that the claims of the ghosts for the ghost shirts were unfounded. Yellowbird died along with Bigfoot in the carnage brought by the Hotchkiss cannons. It could be added that the ghost dance died also because the millennium, of course, didn't come in the spring of 1891. But finally, I would say that the first Wounded Knee was significant because it proved conclusively that the dominant society would not tolerate resistance to the assimilation program that was announced in the Dawes Act of 1887. Now, since some of us may not be familiar with the Dawes Individual Allotment Act, let me next turn to a brief resume of the development of federal policy. I think one can say that two words capture the attitude of white Americans who were responsible for the program of assimilation that emerged in the last half of the 19th century. The first word is expediency, and the second is ethnocentricity. First, I'd like to deal with expediency. In the earliest days of the new American nation, the federal government viewed the Indian tribes, or the Native Americans, if you please, as valuable allies, and for that purpose made treaties with them. Contrary to the popular notion, the boundaries of the country that were described in the treaty that ended the War of the Revolution were not considered permanent. Those lands west of the Appalachians and to the Mississippi had been in constant dispute among various empire seekers. And I would simply assert at this point that the United States proved itself a very effective empire seeker in reference to our portion, so-called portion, of the North American continent. Indians were valuable because they could be used to get control temporarily of the land until white population had an opportunity to occupy it and make the American tenure more secure. This is why treaties were made with Indians as if they were nations on the European model. This is why, too, the government set up a program for carrying on commerce with these native people. A chain of trading posts called factories were established around the perimeter of the United States, beginning among the Cherokees in North Carolina, following the streams that flowed into the Gulf, on up the Mississippi and its tributaries, around to Green Bay, and then along the Great Lakes back to Sandusky on Lake Erie. These posts were there for the purpose of enticing Indians to be loyal to the United States. And this program, which was based on expediency, continued until 1822, by which time the area which the United States originally got by way of the treaty that ended the War of the Revolution, until this was made quite secure. The Floridas were added to the South by a treaty with Spain. The Louisiana Purchase provided a further buffer to the West. Missouri had become a state west of the river. And so it is not surprising that Thomas Hart Benton, who was affiliated with the American Fur Company, should have been instrumental in ending that first Indian policy. A new policy based on expediency was ready. It was a policy of enforced removal, and Andrew Jackson made it effective. The Cherokees, the Creeks, the Chickasaws, the Choctaws, and finally the Seminoles were all forced out of the old Southwest. They were placed in the predicament where they could choose between removal with army escorts to lands in Oklahoma, what is today eastern Oklahoma, or they could remain where they were and be at the mercy of the state, which was no mercy at all. This was politically expedient for Andrew Jackson because the old Southwest furnished the backbone of his political support in 1828, and he intended to run for re-election in 1832. John Marshall, who disagreed with Jackson, did his part to make Indians subordinate by calling them domestic dependent nations and therefore not entitled to defend themselves in the federal courts. That is to say that the Cherokees, up against the state of Georgia, tried to go to the federal court. In the case of the Cherokee versus Georgia, Marshall denied them. They were no longer, you see, nations in the European model. They were a different kind of nation. Yes, the United States would make treaties with them, but these treaties would not have the standing that treaties had with foreign nations. For these were not a sovereign people. treaty making became merely a legal fiction, forgiving an aura of legal sanctity to the removal policy. By the 1850s, it was clear that white people wanted to settle in the region of the Great Plains, to which Eastern Indians had been removed. No sooner had the Indians north of the Ohio River been resettled in Kansas than it was necessary for the government to make new treaties, moving them in with the Indians of Indian Territory, that is what became Oklahoma. Already in the 1850s, of course, Americans, Anglo-Americans now, had cut trails through the plains and the mountains to begin the establishing of Anglo-American culture on the Pacific side of the continent. And therefore, the government began a policy of establishing reservations by treaty where Indian people could be incarcerated away from the main lines of travel. In the same decade came the first allotment treaties. They date from 1854, which is to say that Indians were to be taught the ways of white people during their confinement in preparation for the dissolution of these same reservations. Originally, the government, I think, quite definitely thought that that great expanse, which was known as the Great American Desert, could be for the habitation of Indians. White people probably wouldn't ever want it. In any case, expediency soon dictated that a program of assimilation needed to accompany a program of confinement. Because once the land had been encroached upon on all sides, white people might want the reservations too, or at least the most valuable portions of the reservations. So I'm saying that at this point, ethnocentricity in the form of assimilation became the handmaiden of expediency. The humanitarians, of course, were in the act here. They were as ethnocentric as anybody. And in their eyes, justice required that the inferior culture of Native Americans should be replaced by the superior one brought by the Anglo-Americans. It was under their influence, by the way, that the treaty system was scrapped in 1871. Bishop Whipple of Minnesota had since the 50s been preaching a doctrine of wardship. And in fact, the doctrine or theory of wardship was implemented with the ending of treaty making in 1871. Tribes were no longer recognized, neither were chiefs, and the churches were placed in charge of the reservations. That is to say, the Protestant as well as the Catholic Church, the Protestant churches as well as the Catholic Church, in the 1870s, appointed the agents in turn choosing the teachers, both vocational and academic. Indian people were to be made over in the image of white people by way of missions and the work ethic. By the 1880s, the churches had lost control of the agencies, of the reservations. But the program of assimilation went forward and reached fruition as a policy through the enactment of the Dawes Bill. The idea of the Dawes Bill was, of course, to get rid of tribalism and to get rid of the reservations. It was a theory of the ethnologist Alice Fletcher, who was so influential in shaping this legislation, that to hold land communally was to perpetuate tribalism. And so to get rid of tribalism, it would be necessary to get rid of the reservation. The way to do that was to offer every head of a family, of an Indian family, 160 acres. Every single adult and every orphan, 80 acres. Minor children were to get 40 acres. And the Indians were to have nothing to say about it. The Secretary of the Interior would, in fact, make the decision as to which reservations were to come under the allotment program. And Indian people living on such a reservation would have no choice but to select an allotment within 5 years. If the Indian person did not select an allotment, extra legal courts. They tried to get Congress to pass a law, but Congress somehow did not do so. And so they proceeded, as I've indicated, on an ad hoc basis with a set of rules simply issued by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So I think it should be apparent that the assimilation program had three main emphases in the areas of land distribution, education, and law, the capstone of which was, of course, to be citizenship. Many Indians became citizens through the operation of the Dawes Act of 1887, which remained in force until 1934. Those Indians who did not were made citizens by the Act of 1924. Now, for many reasons, assimilation did not work out as expected, though in terms of destroying Indian culture, it sometimes succeeded all too well. The program for Indian education through the boarding schools and even through the day schools, which were preferred in this period after some failures with boarding schools, especially after the end of the contract schools by 1900. These efforts left very much to be desired. The effects of land distribution under the Allotment Act left Indian people without land sufficient for their support. Let me give you a figure. Tribal land holdings were reduced from 138 million acres in 1887 to 48 million in 1934 when the Dawes Act was repealed. So the point is that the Indian land base was greatly reduced. And as we are aware, Indian people depend greatly upon a land base for support of their culture. Worst of all, I suppose, was the fact that no provision was made for later generations of Indians yet to be born. And in the 20th century, the Indian population turned around and began to increase. They were down to something like 250,000 total population on reservations as the 19th century closed. As everyone knows, I suppose, the Indian population is today increasing. The fact is that by 1934, there were a large number of Indians who had no land, or they had so little land through the process of heirship that what they possessed was simply not viable as an economic unit toward their support. Thus, it was clear that reform was necessary. So contended the American Indian Defense Association, with John Collier as its secretary in the 1920s. And reform began to develop in the days of the Hoover administration, coming to fruition as Franklin Roosevelt assumed the presidency. Harold Ickes became Secretary of the Interior. John Collier, who had championed this cause in the 20s as Secretary of the American Indian Defense Association, now became the Commissioner of Indian Affairs. What was done in 1934 by way of the Indian Reorganization Act, or the Wheeler-Howard Act, had been suggested by way of the Merriam Report of 1928. This was a study done by the Brookings Institution, calling attention to all the deficiencies of the Dawes Act and the other other parts of the assimilation program. I want to say just a little bit about the Wheeler-Howard or Indian Reorganization Act, because I think we often get an inadequate view of that legislation as we listen to militant Indians today. In the first place, as I've said, the Dawes Act was repealed, and once more, tribes were accorded official recognition by the government. They were encouraged to establish tribal councils and to frame constitutions which must be approved by both the tribe and the Secretary of the Interior. The theme of Collier's program was Indian self-determination. Maybe that comes as a surprise to you, because self-determination is what Indian leaders are talking about today. And with Collier, I must say that it was more than a slogan. I feel certain that Collier was quite sincere in trying to bring about changes in the program for the Indian people. It was very democratic. Both Indian men and women were required to vote in favor of the Wheeler-Howard legislation before it could go into effect on any reservation. Most of us, I think, would applaud that. Indians did not have to accept it. And indeed, the Navajos, the largest tribe in the Southwest and a tribe that Collier was greatly interested in, rejected it. And I must say, rejected it largely because of an influential Navajo by the name of Morgan, who was persuaded of the advantages of assimilation under the old Dawes Act program. In any case, the Navajos had no part of it. But two-thirds of the Indian tribes of the country voted in favor of Wheeler-Howard. Some of its provisions included a revolving credit fund to finance Indian enterprises. That is to say, the government put up a fund which was loaned to the tribe. The tribe, in turn, gave the money out to individual Indians, who later paid back the money so that the tribe could once more allocate it for other Indian enterprises. Indian people under this legislation were made eligible for positions in the Indian Bureau without being subject to civil service rules or regulations. That certainly, in the period at least, was called progress, because for the first time, Indians were to have a piece of the action so far as administering their own affairs were concerned. Most important, provision was made for at least a partial recovery of reservation lands lost during the years of the Dawes Act. Provision was made for the purchase of lands that could be put together make the reservations more viable as havens for the tribes. Now, alongside this legislation went a couple of other pieces that deserve mention. The Indian Arts and Crafts Board was established in the same year as Wheeler-Howard for the purpose of validating the authenticity of such items, of items made by Indian people. After all, Indians were in the position of having to compete with the fast buck artists who turned out so-called Indian goods by the industrial process. And here was a board which was dedicated to protecting the authenticity of Indian arts and crafts. I have to applaud that. I simply can't put myself in the position of writing off many of the things that were being accomplished under Collier. I say that this was progress, at least for that time. Johnson O'Malley came in 1935, authorizing the government to contract with the states for services to Indian people, particularly in the area of public education. Now, of course, this was no panacea. I don't claim that. But it seems to me, at least, that the government was moving in the right direction. World War II was hard on this program, and Collier resigned in 1945, disappointed that more had not been accomplished. Then I think things went awry, because, well, they didn't go awry immediately, but ultimately they did. The government was apparently, I mean by this, the Congress, was apparently in a mood to atone for the wrongs of the past. Americans were becoming guilt-ridden. And of course, the way that Americans deal with their guilt complexes most often is to offer hard cash. So, the Indian Claims Commission was created in 1946. Now, there had been a Court of Indian Claims before that, but in each case, the government, the Congress, had to give permission to a tribe if it were going to sue in the Court of Indian Claims. Here was an act which said that any Indian tribe could bring suit in the Court of Indian Claims, first going to the Indian Claims Commission for past wrongs done it by the government of the United States. They were given 5 years to begin their suits, to make their claims. And then there was to be another 5 years in which the adjudication of these claims could occur. Well, as a matter of fact, the Congress has repeatedly extended the Indian Claims Commission provisions. They didn't adjudicate all those claims in the 5-year period, and they kept on extending it. And so far as I've been able to discover, the awards given grow larger and larger. And it remains a question for us to decide whether this is the way, you know, to atone for past wrongs. I hope that the motive is justice and not just the self-interest matter of ridding ourselves of a burden of guilt. But I said a moment ago that things began to go awry, and they did. Because along with atonement by way of Indian claims, the government said, let's get out of the Indian business. Let's terminate our relationship with the tribes, which is a way of saying terminate our responsibility. That movement began in 1947 and reached a climax, or fruition, if you like it better, in 1953. And under the termination program begun in the Eisenhower administration, the Menominee and the Klamath, the Menominee of Wisconsin, the Klamath of Oregon, were terminated. Well, it didn't work out as well at all as some of the theorists had envisioned. The Menominee, for one thing, came under the obligation to pay taxes in the state of Wisconsin. Their lumber mill did not support them. They developed all kinds of difficulties which made it seem wise in the long run that termination be ended, that Menominee County be be abolished and that the reservation be restored. Ada Deer carried on a long effort, a lobbying effort, to get the Menominee Reservation restored, which was finally accomplished in 1972. The 1970s began with new hope. Self-determination without termination, self-determination without termination was the slogan announced by President Nixon in that year. It looked good at first. The Indian Bureau was staffed by a large contingent of Indians. Louis Bruce of Iroquois and Sioux background became the Commissioner of Indian Affairs. But slogans and this manifestation of Indian control at the top proved no solution to a time-worn question. You're aware of the Trail of Broken Treaties, 1972, of the Second Wounded Knee, 71 days in early 1973, the Menominee occupation of the Lexington Brothers Novitiate, early 1975. In these activities, AIM has played a prominent role. What do they want? Well, clearly, they want something different from what they've been getting. We've tried, as I've indicated tonight, a variety of solutions to the problem of Indian-white relations. And I guess I have to conclude by saying that the experience of the early 70s ought to teach us a number of things. First of all, it ought to teach us that in dealing with Indian people, restraint is in order. Compare, if you will, what happened in Washington at the Indian Bureau in the Trail of Broken Treaties, what happened during the 71 days occupation of Wounded Knee, with what happened during the occupation of the Lexington Brothers Novitiate in 1975. In the latter case, restraint was the order of the day. Some might say, no, it wasn't. I'm reading the New York Times. I find that Hugh Simonson, who was in charge of the National Guard, was responsible for restoring the communications, for allowing the food to go in, for reducing the checkpoints, for allowing negotiation under the leadership of Art Lee Skenendorf Sr. to go forward. And in the end, they settled it for $1 and other considerations. The Menominee wanted to establish a hospital there. So I think one thing that we learn is to exercise more restraint. Indians are full up to here of the other kind of response. That is the idea of overwhelming them with force, of which there is obviously plenty available. That doesn't solve anything. Now, hopefully, through the exercise of restraint, militants may in time become more moderate, more subject to negotiation, provided that they can have a major role in the action. What else can one learn from the recent experience? Well, one thing I think is apparent, and that is that there is factionalism among Indian people themselves. It was apparent at the second Wounded Knee. AIM, an urban-based organization, versus the tribal organization under Dick Wilson on the reservation. And I'm not sure I don't think really that white people can deal with that. This is something that will probably have to be worked out among the Indians themselves. Something else in reference to factionalism. The Menominee occupation was carried through by the Menominee Warrior Society, which apparently resented somewhat that the newly elected tribal council included 5 women, including Ada Deer. This tribal council apparently was carrying on negotiations with the Lexan brothers for the transfer of their novitiate to the Menominee tribe before the occupation occurred. That suggests that there are things to be worked out among Indian people. Finally, I would say that the indications are that we are coming to a new day in Indian-white relations. And I base that on the fact that the Indian people themselves are learning more and more how to manipulate the white man's governmental apparatus. They've learned to hire lawyers. They have learned to get rid of those white lawyers in favor of Indian ones as soon as they are available. Whether or not it is possible for Indian people to return to their old culture as they profess is a question that I am not prepared to answer. But in closing tonight, I would say that the signs are hopeful, despite the rhetoric of the militants. And I see that hope mainly in the fact that Indian people, including the militants themselves, are learning how to deal with the federal government in the United States. Thank you. You care to ask some questions, I'll try to respond. Though perhaps you are wanting to catch the last part of President Ford's address or take in the other event on campus involving a Japanese dancer. Yes?
I just had a brief footnote, if I may. I talked with Indians going back to the 1930s, and some of the things you said that I just brought back memories, I have many memories of that experience. This was at the time when the boarding schools were being phased out, at least in northern Minnesota. Many of the entrepreneurs had been to Flat Ground, Haskell, and places of that sort. And the policy at this time now was to have day schools. They had found that the youngsters, having been gone all winter to boarding schools, when they came back to the reservation, just didn't convert the old folks to the white man's way of doing things. They were the ones who reverted back to what the families had been doing. Obviously, you would say, but at least that had been contrary to their thinking. The day school didn't work any better because when they got back home every night, they just lived the way they had always lived. But I'd just like to point out a couple of problems that were excellent. One of them was a health problem. Marilyn Christian was right. I remember at one time the basketball team stayed over a few days in practice to get ready for a tournament, and they averaged a game of weight 5 to 10 pounds per person because they got on a decent diet for a change. To tuberculosis, the highest incidence of tuberculosis in the country, I think, was found on an Indian reservation. And so these were some of the problems that were exhibited. So I look back, I was just a young high school teacher at the time. I was trying to teach these Indians, the white man's type of education. I think it was a mistake. I think we were trying to do the wrong thing. The testing program, it indicated the Indians weren't intelligent enough to be in school. You see, they weren't adapted to the kinds of tests that were given. We made lots of mistakes, and I hope you're right. I hope that the policies and practice now are going to be more tolerable and better.
Well, I'll just make one comment in response to that, Alan. I think it is hopeful that since 1955, Indians have been, in respect to health, under the jurisdiction of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. I think that was a move in the right direction. That is, it was a move against the monolithic control of the Indian Bureau in this area, and it put Indians on the same footing as a white population, should they be in need of health and welfare support, which of course they often were. Something I didn't mention in the address itself. Other questions? Well, unlike other speakers, I am available to you on campus. You simply come to the history office any day. I'll be glad to talk with you. Thank you. Thank you.